providing a trusted and progressive vision of goodness and of action, to work with an energy that inspires others, and to act with loving compassion. This morning in fellowship, we gather to nurture our spirits and put our faith into action. So whoever you are, and whatever brings you to our fellowship this morning, welcome. Newcomers are always welcome at the UUFM. If you are new, or if you've been coming to the UUFM for many years, please join us for coffee and discussion in the foyer after this morning's service. And if you are so inclined, if you're new to the fellowship this morning, or if you would like to introduce guests, please take a moment to introduce yourself or your guests. Any guests? Anybody new to the fellowship? Yeah, please.
This is my second time coming. I came here for the first time last week. Oh, can you hear me better? I just don't want to be too loud. I've been told sometimes I'm way too loud. Okay, once again, my name is Heather. This is my second time coming. I came for the first time last week. And I've lived just a couple blocks down the road on Zeendale, and I've thought about coming, but I've had bad experiences in the past with other, you know, mainstream religion churches, and I finally got over that fear. Had some beloved people pass away recently, and just kind of kick-started something inside of me to just kind of let go of everything else and start making some changes in my life. So I brought my children here. I'm a mother of four. My husband, he couldn't come with me today, but he's in the Army Reserve, and he works Department of Defense on the base. And I'm trying to go back to school, finish up my degree, and trying to start my own business.
Okay. Well, welcome. Welcome, Heather. This morning, I'm going to ask Shauna to light the chalice for us. We have another. I'm sorry.
A latecomer, Molly McGoy. It's just really important to announce that Nick turned 8 yesterday. Hey. And so the kids continue to grow. We can't stop them for some reason.
Hi, my name is Yusha Reddy, and I'm a first grade teacher here in Manhattan Ogden School District. I was here a while ago, and I was here maybe a year or two ago, and decided to come back, and it was a nice day actually to come back, and I keep getting the newsletters still, so I'm reading all of them, and I just wanted to reintroduce myself to UUFM. Thank you.
Well, welcome back.
Hi, my name is Anna, and this is my second time coming here, and it is really great, and I like it because I like the World Travelers thing they're doing with children, and it's fun. Last time we did was Japan thing.
Good. Well, we'll continue in this vein. Are there any other joys or concerns that people would like to express, as long as we're sharing with the congregation? Please, feel free.
Les Frazier. I'm still concerned about getting Rush Limbaugh off the air, and I still have a petition if you want to see me.
Dick Gattell. Our daughter is 60 years old. We just heard she was given the diagnosis of acute myoblastic leukemia. She's a very strong person. She's in very good health, other than, you know, this very sudden illness. And it's one of the types of leukemias where they can plan the treatment based on certain markers, you know. So it's a good possibility of a very good outcome. It's about a 9-month process she's just started. Thank you.
Thank you, Dick.
We just have to say it is totally focusing for our lives now.
I have a joy that today I'm turning 5 and a half.
Well, thank you for the joys and for the concerns. And please be aware that this fellowship shares in joys unspoken and concerns lying close to your heart that may have been unspoken as well. In fellowships across the country, we open our services on Sunday by lighting a chalice. I'll ask Shauna to light our chalice. The chalice is a symbol of our sustenance. Hopefully you have matches. Okay. The chalice is a symbol of sustenance, of the way we care and nurture one another in community, and the way we challenge one another to grow. The flame of our chalice, and that was a cue. The flame of our chalice is a symbol of wisdom and truth. The chalice reminds us of the spark of the divine, the creative light, a flame in all creation and in every human being. Unfortunately, Marilyn Caldwell is not here this morning, so our opening hymn is going to be, and I don't know if I have the number for it, number 118, The Little Light of Mine, This Little Light of Mine. And Michael Oldfather will provide us accompaniment on the guitar so that we all are singing the same tune.
You're going to stand as you're able. There are 3 verses in the hymnal. We're going to do 2 more, and we'll give you a thank notice of what those 2 are.
This little light of mine, I'm gonna let it shine. This little light of mine, I'm gonna let it shine.
Our very own Michael Oldfather on guitar and Dick Biebman accompanying him on the vocals, as well as all of you. Thank you very much. This is the time when the children can come forward. This morning's children's story. I'm going to sit in the back here too because this is one of my favorite stories. Shauna Foster will read the book by Shel Silverstein.
All right, all the kids come forward. Woo, my goodness, or somersault forward. No, I'm okay. So how many of you have already read this book, The Giving Tree by Shel Silverstein? Have you guys heard of this story before? Do you know what it's about? How many of you have a tree in your own yard? You all have a tree? Do you all play on this tree? You do have trees. So you all climb the branches. You climb the branches. If 5 and a half years old today, you climb on the branches of the tree that you have at your house? Oh, you try to climb the branches. That's a good thing to do, too. Well, I always... Oh, what were you going to say? Oh, so she does climb. We have 1 climber out of the whole group that actually climbs trees. Okay, you all do. Very good. Well, I think almost everybody has an experience of a tree in their yard, and this story is about a boy and a tree and a great love that they had together. Much like you, this boy played with his tree, and it made the tree very happy and very glad. But then the boy grew older until he was a little bit older, and he went to the tree and said, "I don't really have time to play in your branches anymore. I need money. Can you give me money?" And the tree goes, "Well, I don't really have a need for money. You know, I have my leaves and my twigs and my apples. But why don't you do this, boy? Why don't you take my apples and take it to market and sell it? And then you can get money." And so the boy took the apple, and the tree was happy, and the tree was glad. So this situation worked out for a little while until the boy became a man. And then he went to the tree and said, "I'm a man now, and now I have need for a house." And the tree said, "Well, I have no house. The forest is where I live, but I have these branches. So come, take my branches and build yourself a house." So the boy came and he took the branches and he built himself a house. And oh, the tree was happy. The tree was glad. Then the boy came a little bit older, maybe midlife crisis age. He finally came to the tree and he said, I have grown cold, and I need to go someplace where it is warm." And the tree said, "Well, I can't provide you with any heat, but I still have my trunk. So why don't you take my trunk and make a canoe? And with this canoe, you can sail down to warmer places." And so the boy sawed down the tree and made a canoe with his trunk and sailed off to warmer places. And the tree was happy, and the tree was glad. Finally, the boy came back, but he wasn't a boy anymore. He wasn't even a man anymore. He was an old man when he came to the tree. And the tree saw him, and he recognized, and the tree rejoiced. But then the tree said, "Sir, I have nothing else to give you. You have taken all of my fruit. You have taken all of my branches. You have taken all of my trunk. The only thing that is left of me is my old stump." And the old man said, "Well, I don't really have a need for any of those things anymore. I just need a place to sit and to rest." And so the tree said, "Well, that's something an old stump can do. Everybody can sit on an old stump. So come, sit on this stump." And so the old man sat down on the stump, and the tree was happy, and the tree was glad. That's it. Oh, you clap for me. Thank you. One fan. Go now in peace. Go now in peace. May the spirit of love surround you.
Thank you, Shauna. Hey, we ask now that you share, and with your generosity, allow us to continue the work of this fellowship and the good works that the folks in this fellowship pursue. Many of you may have noticed that was not "From you I receive and to you I give." But in honor of our visitor this morning, this is the closest I could come. We don't have any Nebraska songs at home. So this song is called "Dubuque." It's off of George Winston CD. Our visitor this morning is Shauna Foster. She is a seminarian attending Meadville Lombard Theological School in Chicago currently. And she is the intern minister at the Unitarian Universalist Fellowship of Topeka. She lives in Omaha, Nebraska, which is north of here. She had a little trouble getting here this morning. She went the wrong way. So when she got to Fargo, she... Her home is in Omaha, where she lives with her husband, Tom, and their two children, Rose and Rex, 5 and 7 years old. In Omaha, Sean was the social justice chair at the local fellowship for over 5 years, and her tireless efforts for social justice include, and this one I just had to ask her to get some clarification, she threw back all of the medals she had earned in the Army at a NATO meeting. She didn't want them anymore. She didn't like what they represent. I'll let her go into that. She was arrested protesting SB 1070, the Arizona illegal immigration law. And most recently, she won the Adult Social Justice Award from the Prairie Star District of the UUs. She enjoys pottery and poetry. And she hopes one day that she will achieve her dream of showing the world the saving force of Unitarian Universalism. So, Shauna, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you very much. So the first reading I have for you is actually from the UUA website, and it's called Why Death is Like the Banana Tree. And it's a folktale from Madagascar. And how it goes is that the very first man and woman were sitting in the garden with God, and God says, you know, I have created you now, and now you have this life. And now it is up to you to decide how you will die. I'm giving you two options. You can either go like the moon, or you can be like the banana tree. And so the man and the woman, the very first ever to live, were looking at each other and kind of thinking about this. And they said, well, God, what does that mean? What do you mean, either like the moon or the banana tree? That doesn't make any sense. And they said, well, you know, the moon dies every month. It slowly but surely gets smaller and smaller in the sky until it is only a tiny sliver of silver. But then it's reborn and grows bigger every day until it is round and full in the sky. Every month it is the same. The moon grows smaller and then bigger in exactly the same way over and over again forever. And the man and the woman, they thought about this. They weren't sure they liked the idea of getting smaller and smaller and smaller until they died. But it was reassuring to think that they would always be born again. So they asked, what would it be like to die as the banana tree? Well, God answered, the banana tree must die. It will never come back. But first, it puts out green shoots that grow up to be a new banana tree. Before dying, the banana tree helps to create new life. Which one will you choose? And the man and the woman considered this for a very long time. They talked about it all night long, looking into the sky to watch the moon, which was beautiful and full. If they chose the moon, they would never die, but life might get boring and lonely. They would only have each other for company. There would be no one else. If they chose the banana tree, they would have children to love, but in time, they would grow old and die. So finally, they decided they would rather experience the joy and the miracle of bringing new life into the world, even if it meant they would not be reborn like the moon. They told God they would rather die like the banana tree, and so it was that the first man and the first woman chose love. They had many children together, and their children had many children, and the children filled their hearts and lives with love and joy for all the days of their lives. Finally, when they were very old, the time came for the first man and the first woman to return to the earth, to never come back, just as the banana tree does when it dies. And since that time, all humans have died to make room for new life to grow. So that is the first reading. The second reading is a little bit more lecture-oriented because it's about the Norse mythology of Yggdrasil. The metaphor of a tree used in so many myths and scriptures to depict the cosmos is remarkably exact. We know exactly how on Earth, with every spring, the flow of forces infuse their growing power into each limb and leaf, giving beauty and perfection to blossoms, which in the course of time ripen into fruit which bear the seeds of future trees, and how, when the year draws to its close, the sap returns to the root system, nourishing it and providing firmer foundation for the next year's growth. We see an analogy to this in every human life as well. As a child is soft and delicate, but increases in bulk and weight until middle life, thereafter the process reverses itself, culminating in the transparent fragility of the very old. So in the embodiment of worlds do the divine powers imbue lament, unform maxture with character, structure and shape, increasing substance and solidity. The layered cosmos expands from within, branching through all grades of matter until a limit is reached for the phase of evolution, whereupon the life forces retreat back to the spiritual realms as the divine root receives into itself the essence or aroma of experience. And see, Yggdrasil nourishes all beings with a life-giving honeydew. This is from the Norse mythology. The worlds pendant from its branches are on all shelves in existence, receive from the divine roots what is needful for growth. Predisposition from the well of Erd, material substance from the well of Mimir, an appropriate means of expression from Hivgalmr's rivers of lives. And at death, when the spirit draws the nutrient sap back into its roots, the seeds of future embodiments remain as an imperishable record, while the empty shell of matters is recycled for future use, much as the leaves falling from a tree in winter become mulch to enrich the soil. And so it is said that the stars at night are actually the leaves of this world tree, and the constellations are its branches. This is the tree of life that sustains and is ever present in all of us. I want to thank you all for inviting me to this fellowship hall today. I think this is a glorious sanctuary. This is the first time I've ever seen it, and I can't help but notice, but over here you have a perfect view of a great tree. How wonderful and timely. But I want to talk to you about trees, actually. I don't think you all know this, but Nebraska is home of Arbor Day, and Nebraska has 3 forests. I didn't even know that until they sent me a survey as a Nebraska resident. What should we do to protect Nebraska's forests? I was like, we have forests? What? But apparently we have 3. They were planted by J. Sterling Morton, and that's why we're the home of Arbor Day. So I think trees are just so interesting and all the things that we can learn about them. For instance, there was this one experiment in the desert where they wanted to grow apple trees in the desert. Have you guys heard about this? They wanted to grow apple trees in the desert, but, you know, apple trees don't grow very well in the desert, so they put a dome over these apple trees. And the trees grew and they grew and they grew and they grew, and then finally when they were old enough to have their first harvest, all of the fruit was so weightful on the branches that the branches broke off and the trees died. And the scientists who were testing this experiment said that the reason why that happened is because there was no wind inside of the dome. So there was no wind to strengthen the branches so that the tree could hold up its own fruit. And on my street is pretty magical, I think. I think I should make it like a holy site, because down the street from me, there's this maple tree, and its trunk comes up like this, and then there's like 7 or 9, depending how you count it, branches going around in a circle like this, and in the middle of that is a fir tree. A 3 to 4-year-old sapling fir tree growing right in the middle of that. And I'm thinking, if it were an earlier time, we would have been marking this thing off to figure out what's going to happen. Because to me, it's kind of like a tension of nature. Like, what's going to survive? Is the fir tree going to survive? Is the maple tree going to survive? What's going to happen to that? And it's such a rare sight. And so there's another really great tree on my street. And I've lived in the same neighborhood for 20 years now. And there's this huge old oak tree across from a church. And did you all have storms here about a few days before Father's Day? Because we had like 70-mile-an-hour winds in Nebraska. I mean, it was like tree Armageddon when we got out of the movie theater and came back out. There were downed trees everywhere. There were downed limbs. There were limbs hanging from trees, like eerily trying to touch our cars. We were driving underneath it. And this huge old oak tree had fallen in half, had split in half, like kind of like a jagged line, and fallen on a house. And that would be kind of crappy to come home to. I don't think they were home yet. And so this tree had just destroyed this house. And it was the dark of night, so we didn't really know what had happened, but it was a huge, huge old tree. And so we go down there the next day because the police have marked it off like it's a crime scene, like caution all the way around this tree because it's fallen in the house. And we go up and we talk to the owner, and we're standing around the tree talking about it, and I notice that, you know, normally when a tree, when you cut it, it's got all those tree rings and everything strong on the inside, you know. This tree is rotten to the core. You touch it, and it's like dust crumbling underneath your fingers. And this is so amazing to me because I've known that tree for 20 years. 20 years I've known this tree with perfect branches, acorns whenever acorns come out. I mean, it's just a perfect-looking tree that doesn't seem like there's anything wrong with it. And yet to find out with one storm, and it was a lightning strike, it cleanly split the tree down where the lightning tore a jagged path in it and fell onto the house. And so I talked to the owner, and I said, how can this be that this tree looks so perfect and yet is rotten to the core? And he said, it's got rotten roots. You can't see the roots. And then the roots did not feed the tree, and so it grew on the outsides of itself. And I think, well, that's a pretty darn powerful metaphor for what we can take for Unitarian Universalism. Is Unitarian Universalism, what is it like? Is it like a tree, a great old tree with 9 branches and the inside something completely new is growing on the inside? Or is Unitarian Universalism like something that has never had its branches tested, and so when its spiritual fruit comes in, the branches fall to the ground? Or is Unitarian Universalism like the oak tree that looks great and has looked great for a long time, but with one storm and one lightning strike, is blown to the ground. Well, the only way that we can find this out for sure is by examining the roots of Unitarian Universalism, to make sure that it's feeding the core of our religion. And so one of the roots I think of, you know, it's pretty easy with Unitarian Universalism to think of our roots, because we can think of the Unitarian root and the Universalist root. And this is actually a very debated subject among theologians today, when Unitarianism actually started. I mean, some people say it's specifically an American phenomenon of the Transcendentalists. You know, it only started in America, it's the only religion like it, so it's not very old. But then others say that the first Unitarian goes back to 300 AD to the Council of Nicaea. Now, the Council of Nicaea is the early meeting in Christianity when they canonized and codified the Bible, and they said, these are the only books that are ever going to be in the Bible forever and ever, amen. That's the council that decided, and that is also the council where they decided to do the Trinity. And there was one pope there, his name was Origen, who hated the Trinity. He said, you absolutely cannot do the Trinity, because the Trinity divides God. The Trinity divides humanity. It says that Jesus is more than what he actually is, which is just a man, divinely inspired by God. And so we could say that guy was the first Christian Unitarian. But we could even go back further, I think, into the Unitarian roots, because part of what was affecting the Americans here in the United States is that they were looking at other religions. They were looking at things like the Hindu religion. The Hindu religion, depending on who you ask, is polytheistic or atheist. The Hindu religion has no creed. And Hindu adherents say that it is a religion that you have to experience, that cannot be explained. A non-creedal religion that's pretty hard to explain, that sounds a lot like another religion that I know pretty well. So that, I think, in Hinduism is one of the oldest religions out there that's still going on today. So we could say our Unitarian roots, the idea that we are all one, that's a pretty very ancient, old prehistory, probably, for the experience of human beings. And then you look at the Universalist history. Again, people could say that the Universalist history is a completely, strictly American phenomenon. And maybe you could trace it back to Europe, to the Albigens. And they were the first people who said that, you know what, when Jesus died on the cross and was for the salvation of the rest of the world, that that worked. That worked at the time. You don't need to prove yourself again. So everybody is universally saved. That was about 1150 in Europe that they said that. But I think that the idea of love and compassion is much older than that. If you go and look up one of the old names for God in the Jewish Bible, it's Yahweh. And Yahweh, literally translated, means I am with you. I am with you. It is a promise that something greater than ourselves individually is always with us. In fact, when you look up the word compassion and you look at the literal definition of compassion, it means to sit with, to be with someone else. And so we can look back into those ancient, ancient, deep roots into what forms our Unitarian Universalism today. I think those two roots form a giant taproot that goes very, very deep and has many tendrils into many things. So now I'm going to tell you a story about a couple of lives that are Unitarian Universalist. One is from my home church in Nebraska. A young woman came to my church. When I first met her, she was 19 years old and she was pregnant, was not married. She grew up with a pretty conservative background, and so she was like, well, you know, I have to go to college no matter what, and I'm pro-life, so I'm going to have this baby and give it up for adoption because I need to go to college. And she had come from a very abusive background. Her parents divorced at 10. Her dad beat her all the time. She didn't have any family around because, you know, off of Air Force Base is there. So she was Air Force, and so the military was pretty much all she had known. And she came to this church, and she was very shiftless, too. I mean, she jumped around from job to job to job. She moved around from place to place to place. She had all these different partners. I mean, just not a very stable life. And so too was her spirituality. I mean, she came in, she was an agnostic, and then I talked to her 2 years later, and she's an atheist, and I talked to her a year later, she's a Buddhist, I talked to her a little bit after that, she's Christian again. I mean, she's just all over the place. But the thing that kept her in our church, she says, is that it didn't matter how shiftless she was in her beliefs, that she always had a community there willing to accept her and willing to accept her work. And so, you know, my church debates about a lot of things, about feminism, about ecology, about information reform, immigration reform, about healthcare reform, you know, all those politics. But it wasn't the politics that brought her there, because she was fairly conservative. If somebody tried to press the democratic liberal agenda on her, she probably would have left. It was the religion of universal acceptance and the communal bonds of that church. And she was so moved by that faith that she took the love she felt from that community and she answered a call to ministry. And so that's the woman who's standing in front of you right now as a Unitarian Universalist. And the church is my church, First Unitarian Church of Omaha. And that's what I mean when I say that Unitarian Universalism is a saving force in a society of divisiveness and fundamentalism. I'm going to tell you another story. I swear this one's not about me. This one's about Marguerite. Now, Marguerite, 20 years ago, had come over the border for a better life. And back then, immigration laws were kind of lax. I mean, Reagan, he said that untaxed immigrant labor is the tax base for our society so that we can have the kinds of things we have. So it was all right if people from Mexico came up and did all of the work that we needed to do. So that's what she came in and she did. And so she came up there and she married a U.S. citizen. She got a green card and she had two kids. And since immigration was not a hot button issue that it is in these times, she didn't ever bother to reapply for her green card. And she didn't ever bother to become a U.S. citizen because it just wasn't necessary. And she had two kids she had to work for. And she worked as a maid every day. It's hard to find the time to become a U.S. citizen when you have those kinds of pressures on you. And so it came that around in 2009, her mother was very ill with cancer back in Mexico. So she went back to Mexico to be with her dying mother. And she kind of figured, well, I could just cross the border to get back like I did 20 years ago. And she was wrong. So her mother died, and there she is in Sasabe, which is just across the border from Tucson, Arizona. And she is in Sasabe filling up her backpack full of Red Bull and water for the trek against the desert. And this is where the coyotes are. The coyotes are the people who lead these people across the border for a very high price. And she's about to go with this coyote, and all over Sasabe are these signs that say, "You do not have to go. People die in the desert." But for Marguerite, she has to go. All her family that was in Mexico is dead now. And she considers herself to be an American, really. Just the immigration stuff isn't quite figured out for her yet. So she is going across the desert, and she starts to slow down, and she can't keep up with the group. And she tells them, "Go on without me, because I know I'm risking the entire group." She has accepted her fate to die in the desert, because she doesn't want to risk all these other people who are also trying to go. And she runs out of water, and for 4 days she's hiding behind bushes and not listening to anything and not trying to do anything, because she heard that if she ever is left alone in the desert, that any man that finds her will rape her. And she's afraid of the border patrol. So there she is in the desert, and she assumes that this is it. This is the way I'm going to die. Until she hears a voice call out, "No tienes miedo." Do not be afraid. Somos amigos de la iglesia. We are friends of the church. Tengo agua, comida, y recursos Mexicos. We have water, food, and medical attention. And they say, if you need something, call out. And so she calls out, and the people that come to save her are Unitarian Universalists. Because the Tucson Valley Unitarian Universalist Church, their primary ministry is no more deaths, no más muertes. And so they go and patrol the border for people like Marguerite. And for people like Marguerite, they help her get back to her life in America and get her back on the right path to citizenship. That is also part of No Más Muertes. So she is back reunited with her family because of Unitarian Universalists, rather than dying in the desert like Yoselin, Yoseline was another 14 years old young woman found in the desert, but she had already died. And so what do Unitarians Universalists do? Do they just let this young girl die in the desert? No. They hire somebody, and Beacon Press publishes a book called The Death of Yoseline that talks about immigration debate, that talks about the immigrants, that talks about the view from the Border Patrol agents, from the Minutemen, from the legislators, from the healthcare officials, and even in fair view of what is going on across the desert. They don't let the immigration system silence Yoseline's story. They make it so that it is something the entire denomination should read. And then they have an entire Justice Assembly, General Assembly, about this very issue. They don't let Yoseline die in the desert alone. Her story lives because of Unitarian Universalists. So the question is, why? Why do we do this? Why do people in Tucson wander around in the desert looking for people, illegally, I might add? You're not allowed to provide aid to people who are crossing or transport them or anything. So they're risking their livelihoods in doing this as well. Why would a church welcome a 19-year-old girl that was knocked up into their midst? Why would we do this? And I think it goes back to our roots. It goes back to Unitarian Universalism. Because when you say Unitarian Universalism, you're not just saying two nouns that we happen to put together. You're saying an adjective that modifies a noun. Unitarian modifies universalism. There's all kinds of people who claim that they're universalist, but how they do it is say, you believe whatever I believe, and then you'll be saved. So your universalist mileage might vary a little bit. I think it goes the longest with Unitarian Universalism, because the Unitarian says that we are all one, and that there's no way that you can be divided by what you believe. And that is the universalism that says the communal love of our fellowships and our denomination are what save us all. So when you go back and think about the trees outside here, or the oak tree that I've talked about, or the trees that can't bear their fruit, or the tree that has another tree growing inside of it on my street, when you think about these trees, you can think about what is your own Unitarian Universalism look like? What kind of spiritual tree would represent how you feel about Unitarian Universalism? But remember that the tree of Unitarian Universalism is like Yggdrasil, the great tree of life believed in Norse mythology. Modern-day pagans believe that each person is a tendril of this ever-growing tree. Yggdrasil has no beginning or end. There is no creation story of how the tree came to be, and at the end times, the tree will be there to replenish the rest of us. We all have a representation and connection with this tree, according to modern paganism, and are an individual manifestation of it. And so I like to think that's symbolic for what it means to be a Unitarian Universalist and to have a Unitarian Universalist life. May it be so. Do we have time for discussion? Oh, you're kidding. You guys have it for that long? I'm an hour church kind of person. You get in, you get out. Have a great Sunday. Amen, that's right. So does anybody want to have a little discussion?
Go ahead.
One is coming to you. Oh.
Thank you. That was very thought-provoking. I enjoyed that. I've always thought the Unitarian part of Unitarian Universalism went back to the roots as far as tying us in with the disjointness or the split that occurred in Nicaea, so that Unitarian, okay, well, that's the Christian aspects, the Christian roots, you know, the one God sort of thing. But what you said was the Unitarian can be interpreted as well as we are all one. Mm-hmm. And I've never heard that pursuit. Is that a line of thought in your thinking? Not going back to the Christian roots, but the Unitarianism of everybody?
If you go back and you look at the great Unitarian thinkers, you can see that they were also, at the same time they were publishing revelations in Unitarian theology, they were also studying other religions. Like, it was Unitarians who transcribed Buddhist texts for the first time into English to be available. Because our religion is a religion that studies their faith. So, like, it comes from the Enlightenment, where we studied from the Latin. We went back to the original Greek and Hebrew and tried to figure out what was actually said and what actually makes kind of sense here. And so we were always studying religious texts, and so you can find a pretty clear correlation where a lot of our notable Unitarian thinkers were studying other religions.
You're very good. You'll go far. Well, you mentioned those roots that aren't too good with UUs. What are we going to do to improve those roots? We evidently have some of them growing. We're growing here. What do we do to make this great program available to all the people that want it and should have it?
Well, I don't know y'all's church very well, so I can't answer it specifically. And I think that actually, I'm not very qualified to do that either. So I think that a really great answer to that actually was recently. Have y'all ever heard of the Berry Street Lecture? The Berry Street Lecture? It's the one that ministers give to each other at ministry days, right before General Assembly. Yeah, we love sermons. We can't help ourselves. So anyway, so we go and we find the best sermonizer of the time every year, and we call it the Berry Street Lecture. And then this you know, is the paramount honor and sermon of the year. And so this year's sermon, I think, answers that question very much directly. And so if y'all Google it, or just go to the uua.org.com, Berry, B-E-R-R-Y, or no, B-A-R-R-Y. Yeah, Berry Street Lecture. And if you look that up, I mean, I just heard the most amazing sermon about the three things that's holding Unitarian Universalism back. And I don't remember exactly what those all are. But the number one thing that is going to move us forward is the recognition of beloved community. You're welcome.
When you talk about what kind of a tree is Unitarian Universalism, what comes to my mind is this apple tree that used to grow in what used to be called Grandma Martin's orchard up in my hometown. It had grafted two or three different kind of trees on one trunk. Mm. So you had red apples, you had summer apples, and you had Jonathan's growing on the same tree.
Wow.
I don't know if they still do this or not, but this is back in the late 50s, early 60s, and that was sort of a phenomenal thing to see these kind of multiple apple trees. And I think that is a lot. I mean, last weekend here, we were talking about paganism.
Mm-hmm.
Today we're talking about our historical roots as Unitarian Universalists. It seems like every week we have a different fruit that we talk about and look at, but it all comes from the same trunk and the same root system, nourishes it. And I think, you know, there's some real interesting history in especially when you talk about the Unitarians' concept, because, you know, prior to the Reformation of Martin Luther, there was this whole Reformation going on in Slovakia, Romania, Hungary, that was a Unitarian movement. The Catholic Church, of course, saw that in the Habsburgs of Austria's heresy. But they said, how can we divide God into three people? Mm-hmm. And so they embraced that concept of oneness. And back when I was studying the Bhagavad Gita long time ago in a land far, far away, I remember there was one of those stories I heard where, you know, a student goes to a sage and asks, how many gods are there? And the sage says, well, how many do you think there is? And the student began reciting off all the different gods that he had studied in the tradition. And the teacher, the sage, said, no, you need to go study some more and come back. And so he did, and he came back, and the question was still, how many gods are there? And finally, after many tries, the student said, there's just one. And that's when I look out on our culture, I think we forget that. If God is God, then there's one God, be it Hindu, Buddhist, Muslim, whatever. Mm-hmm. And we fail to see the interconnected web of life as a result of that. And I think that is probably the greatest thing Unitarian Universalism could be showing, especially the American culture right now.
Well, thank you. Yeah, I appreciate the additional metaphor for Unitarian Universalism. And so my question is, you know, how do you know that you actually have different kinds of fruit that you're offering people? How do you know that for sure? And how strong are our branches to hold up that fruit? And how strong is the core? And how deep are our roots? You know, to add to a metaphor on a metaphor on a metaphor. and I also think about the Hindu story that you were talking about, because in the Hindu religion, there is no such thing as heresy or apostasy or blasphemy, because each person is living their own individual truth, but they're united together in a common community. And then one last comment about the Europeans. We've had one Unitarian king. He was in Transylvania, King Sigismund. And I forget, was it Francis David who said, we need not think alike to love alike? And that's what he convinced the Transylvanian king with, because the Transylvanian king was thinking about adopting Catholicism, which meant he would have to put a lot of his people to death. And he decided to go Unitarian instead. So we got one guy there.
Hi. I just have one thing to add, since Hinduism has come up twice, that Hinduism is actually monotheistic. In fact, the gods and goddesses that we know are so abundant in Hinduism are all different manifestations of the one Brahman.
Right. I mean, I think that's good, because a lot of modern Western experiences of Hinduism has tended to put it into the polytheistic boat. And so I think it's a more accurate representation to say it's monotheistic, but they also have atheist traditions as well. And what they say is it depends on the local region and the community on how they practice their Hinduism, but that the core belief is that each person has their own expression of the divine, however you want to define divine. Okay, so this will be the last two over here.
I think I believe everything happens for a reason, and I'm so glad I came today. I've never heard so much discussion about Hinduism wherever I went in Kansas, so this is very insightful, and I'm very happy to be here today, and it's been the best educated dialogue I've heard in a long time, and all of you are right on the mark. It is monotheistic. It is seeing the divinity in every person that comes along with you. And there are so many myths and fallacies that are easy to hold on to just to create that barrier. Mm. We're too afraid to know about other religions because they might be just like ours. So I'm really happy to be here. Thank you.
I guess I come from a Unitarian church in Chapel Hill. And one of the major things we struggled with was developing an electronic ministry and how to outreach and grow the congregation. And I guess I'm curious what you think Unitarian Universalism has to offer in cultures like this one to grow.
Yeah, I actually think that, you know, that the Midwest, I'm sure you all read the book, What's the Matter with Kansas, right? Y'all in Kansas, so I hope. Anyway, and I think that, you know, this place used to be a place of community, that the Midwest, and I'm counting myself, Nebraska as well, used to be a place of community, of that beloved community, but then with forced desegregation came a lot of fear of the other. And I think that certain political parties manipulated that fear and codified it and diversified it. And that's what I think that Unitarian Universalism has to offer, to say we don't have to be afraid of other people. We don't have to be afraid anymore. We don't have to have a war on drugs or criminalize immigration or anything like that, because we're all the same. So that's why I feel it's very important to have Unitarian Universalist communities in the Midwest, especially because we have such a different heritage than the East Coast and the West Coast Unitarians. We really do. because we are out here on the plains, you know, putting the rubber to the road of saving people, whereas I feel like, you know, the coasts are a little different. Sorry if y'all are from the coast. But anyway, you know, so I just feel it's a little different. And that we're really out here, and we're like, this is where humanism flourished for the first time, is out here in the Midwest, where new theological innovations were created to meet the needs of the people, because it was kind of like the wild, wild west out here. And it still really, in many ways, is. Whereas in the coast, there was a culture that you had to fight against and a tradition that you had to fight against to get it changed. I mean, you look at a lot of the Unitarian people we lift up, a lot of them left Unitarianism. A lot of them left Universalism because they were spurned by the tradition and the institution. And you don't really have that in the Midwest because it was, you know, kind of a free-for-all sort of thing. So that's why I feel that Midwest Unitarian Universalism is very important. And as far as the electronic thing, you know, there's the Church of the Larger Fellowship, which is basically, at GA, we voted this year to change the definition of membership to require bricks and mortar. So you can have a fellowship completely online now. I guess you could all leave and meet on the internet if you want. I mean, but it's not required. And that, so now the Church of the Larger Fellowship is an authentic church that is really part of Unitarian Universalism. And I think Peter Morales wrote a white paper about this, about how people are meeting and making meaning in completely different ways that we're used to, and yet we're still trying to force this New England everybody comes to church model on them. So I think that's the way to go, and technology will definitely help us facilitate to do that. But, I mean, I love church. I love coming to church and seeing people. So we'll see how the future develops for that. Yeah. Okay, so if you'll join me in singing our closing hymn, Rise in Body or Spirit, singing number 346, Come Sing a Song with Me.
Sing a song with me that I might know your mind. And now may the blessings of life be upon us and upon the congregation. May the memories we gather here give us hope for the future. And may the love that we share bring strength and joy to our hearts. And the peace of this community be with us all until we meet again. Amen.